The Ark is a source of unspeakable power, and it has to be researched.
And it will be, I assure you, Dr. Brody. Dr. Jones, we have top men working on it right now.
Who?
Top men.
Hello, you're listening to The Letterboxd Show, our podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. I'm Gemma, they're Slim, and like many film lovers this month, we are ready to get into the spooky season. And before we talk to our very first special guest of spooky season, Ty West, no big deal, we should mention that this episode is sponsored by our best friends at Shudder, the premier streaming service for horror, thriller, and the supernatural. And with Halloween fast approaching, there is no better time to dive into Shudder's unbeatable collection of new and classic scares. Do you have Shudder, Slim?
Gemma, you know I have Shudder. I would never let that subscription lapse. As long as I live, it's the home for Halloween with original series and movie premieres every week, including a new film from Dario Argento, Dark Glasses, and VHS 99, the latest in the hit found footage franchise, hot off its world premiere at TIFF, both premiering this month. And Shudder has two new series that are must-see for movie history fans, the 101 Scariest Horror Movie Moments of All Time, where filmmakers and genre experts like Edgar Wright and Mike Flanagan count down horror's greatest scares, and Queer for Fear, a four-part series on the history of queer horror from executive producer Brian Fuller.
It's too much. I'm going to have to keep a Shudder subscription going all year, not just October. Speaking of which, until the end of October, Shudder is also offering 31% off new annual subscriptions. Go to shudder.com and use the promo code HOME. Get to it. But let's talk about how we're kicking off the month of October. Slim, when I look at the most popular films on Letterboxd right now, so many of the top films are horror, 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 with women at the bloody heart of them. And the most horrific and entertaining of all is Pearl, a character we met in her senior years in the movie X earlier this year, which director Ty West followed crazy fast with Pearl's origin story, and that is in cinemas now.
We had to get Ty on the show. No way we could start Halloween without him, and there are indeed a few scary movies in his four favorites, which are Peter Jackson's Bad Taste, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Tulane Blacktop, and Toby Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Ty, welcome to the Letterboxd Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
How are you? It's been a bit of a whirlwind putting not just one, but two movies out in a year, you crazy man.
Yes, it's turned out to be quite a busy year for me. I went to New Zealand a year and a half ago or so, or almost 2 years ago now. And I was planning on being there for 3 months, maybe four, if I wanted to like see some sights. And next thing you knew, I was there for 13 months making two movies, and I haven't had a day off since basically Halloween 2 years ago.
Christ.
Oh my God, we do that to people. We suck them in, Ty. We suck them in. There is, as the resident New Zealander on the show, there is a tradition in New Zealand current affairs where it's because we're such a tiny, sad little country of desperados at the bottom of the world. The first question, this is the running national joke, the first question that any famous visitor gets asked is, so what did you think of New Zealand? Do you like us?
It worked out. I had been to New Zealand once before, but only for like 2 days. This time I was there, as I said, for 13 months, and it was great. I mean, we were there because of COVID. And at the time it was like at the peak of COVID and there was no COVID in New Zealand. So you could safely make a movie there. And so that was great in its own right. But we just had an amazing experience, and living in Wellington for a year was like fantastic for me. And I had a really like, you know, everything about the country was like perfect for the movie and was perfect for our time there. And the crew was amazing. And so, you know, outside of maybe like not being able to get everything off Amazon in 2 days, they had everything else we could possibly need, or eBay for that matter. Sometimes we were doing some shopping for the movie being like, how are we going to find it here in the midst of a pandemic? But other than that, I mean, it's a really great place. I would encourage anyone to visit it.
Wellington's a really small town. And given that he directed the first film that we're going to talk about today, did you go around to Peter Jackson's house and play with his dolls and look at his poster collection? Did you not sign an NDA?
That would have been cool, but no. I did edit the films at Park Road, which is his facility, and so he was working on Get Back at the time. So I'd see him in the hallways now and again. I met him once very briefly, but we were both like, you know, he was racing towards three movies again, and I was racing towards two movies, doing my best to keep up with the New Zealand tradition. And we were pretty much locked in our rooms most of the time. So, but we were probably more or less the only two people working in the facility because there wasn't really anything else going on there. So.
Well, some people have called your World of X your Lord of the Rings, really, in comparison, you know, the three movies.
Interesting. Well, I don't know what to make of that, but there's certainly two of them. There will be three. So at least that similarity is there. I mean, it became the running joke, of course, in New Zealand that when we sprung it on the crew, like, we think we're going to make another movie back to back. And they were like, ah, sweet ass. They were pretty ready for it.
I love that story. Before we started recording, you were telling us about how every New Zealander texts you sweet ass and you're like, where's the other S?
Yeah.
Like, what's going
on? Or where's the rest of the sentence more specifically? We just kept thinking they were trying to say some larger thing and they just got cut off or something. And then eventually we discovered that, no, this is just the lingo.
I thought the same thing with Gemma and Matt at Letterboxd. I think just let it ride for 6 months before I even bothered to Google what they were saying. I was like, I'll figure that out at some point later. But so we'll drift into Pearl later in this discussion. It's in theaters. I saw it yesterday. I went to see it. There was me and I saw 1 p.m. showing of Pearl. But before we get into your faves and Pearl later, can you just give us a taste of what to expect, maybe visually with Maxine? Because the teaser trailer for Maxine has come out and it had this like awesome VHS style 80s vibe. Have you thought about like what you want people to expect with the third movie with Mia, and like the visual vibes in Pearl were out of sight? But what do you have in mind that you can at least mention early for Maxine?
The thing is, we made X and we kept Pearl a secret the whole time that we made it. And then we sort of dropped this little teaser for Pearl slash an announcement that it existed at South By for the premiere of X. And then we kept Maxine a secret for the whole time through Pearl, and then it dropped this little thing at Toronto. So I'm going to just continue on with the saga of keeping a secret. I think in 2022, or in this case, perhaps in 2023, it's very rare to know a lot about a movie. And to not know everything that happens in this movie. And for me as a filmmaker and as just a film fan, I would be excited if I didn't know if there was some interesting trilogy of movies and I didn't know what to expect from them. So I'm going to be a bit cagey and probably say like, it's going to be as starkly different from X as Pearl was, but it's not going to be like Pearl.
Very political. We'll allow it.
Diplomatic.
And the teaser is like in the ballpark for sure. I mean, the teaser's not arbitrary. I mean, it's not necessarily like the teaser has a little bit more like teaser aesthetic going to it. You know, I'm not going to shoot the movie on VHS or anything like that, but it's about a different era and a different type of filmmaking in a different type of era.
It's not going to be shot in rural New Zealand yet again, unlike Peter Jackson's 1987 debut, Bad Taste.
It is less rural than Bad Taste, yes.
So I'm excited to get into this. I've seen this movie so many times. I didn't even rewatch it this week for this conversation, but it's a rite of passage in New Zealand. You know, it's just what we watch on the weekends. The population of a small town disappears and is replaced by aliens that chase human flesh for their intergalactic fast food chain. When did you first see this film, Ty?
Hard to know for sure. I saw it once when I was relatively young, probably in the early 90s. So I was probably like 12 or 13, somewhere in there. And it was just a gross movie. And I only saw it because it had a middle finger on the box cover and it just seemed like it was daring me to rent it. And I didn't think much of it other than it was gross and there was a puke scene that was really gross. But then when I started getting interested in filmmaking, and which is maybe like three or four years later maybe, I was revisiting a lot of stuff and I was looking at movies very differently because I was thinking about them as like from the perspective of a filmmaker rather than the perspective of someone who just watched movies. And I think I had probably rewatched maybe Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2 and been like, well, there's a lot of really amazing craft in these movies that if you weren't thinking about that were just these like crazy gross horror movies. But if you were thinking about craft, you were like, wow, actually this is very inventive of Sam Raimi and whatever. And so in doing that, I think I went back, or maybe Brain Dead, Dead Alive was the beginning of me thinking about Peter Jackson in a more of a filmmaker perspective. And so I went back to Bad Taste then, and I would say that the reason I put it on the list, you would think I put it on the list because I went to New Zealand and made movies and A Person Plays Two Characters, all these things that seem now to be very conveniently like apropos to choose this movie. But it's weirdly just a strangely organic situation because it was the first movie that made me think I could make movies. Because when I watched Bad Taste from the perspective of a filmmaker, I realized that it was just some guy doing it. And he was playing the part himself, and he was playing two parts himself, and those were his friends, and this was clearly his hometown. And his hometown was as irrelevant to the world of filmmaking as mine was, because he, like, Wellington, New Zealand meant absolutely nothing to me. And just like Wilmington, Delaware meant absolutely nothing to anyone else for that matter. So it became apparent to me that, like, oh, the camera's just on a car. Like, I see how he's making this. And it was the first time I could get a sense of, like, you could just go and do it. You'd have to have the follow through to do it, and you'd have to be, like, inspired and talented and all these things. But technically speaking, if you could get a bunch of people together and organize that and commit, you could make a movie. And so that was really why that movie became so profound to me. And the fact that that really had that impact on me, and then to many years later, be in New Zealand making two movies in a row where one character plays two characters and then being at the same post, it was incredibly surreal and strange because it wasn't like I planned that. And it wasn't even as if like I was thinking about Bad Taste when making the movie, or it had nothing to do even why I was thinking about Mia playing two roles. Like, it was just completely not on my mind. And then it just became this really weird full circle that, like, here I am with the world on pause making two movies, standing in the place where a movie that made me go like, ah, I could probably do this was. I mean, it was very strange. And so it was, profoundly unique situation to find yourself in.
Fewer exploding sheep in your film.
That is true. Yeah, there was a little, like, we did have some brains and some exploding heads, but yeah, not as many exploding sheeps or chainsaws going through people and not a big, puke meal. But
Slim, I need to know because, you know, I said it's a rite of passage for New Zealanders. Like, I think we all watch it when we turn 13 or something. It's sort of compulsory. But was this a first-time watch for you, Peter Jackson's debut?
I had this logged on Letterboxd. This was the first time I, like, sat down to pay attention to watch it. And it was more of an eye-opening experience for me. The gore in this is so fun. And I agree. If I had seen this when I was younger, I would have had the same feeling, like, I could do this. Like, I can see Peter Jackson and his friends having fun doing this on weekends. Like, why am I not doing this? You know, and I think I got those vibes maybe from the first time I saw Evil Dead. That was maybe, like, you know, my American version. But it's so invigorating to see someone be able to do this decades ago. And I think it's still fun. It's still a hoot to watch today. It's not like there was no real point in this movie. I was like, man, that's really dated. Like, man, their budget really stunk there. Because, like, when they're doing the rocket launcher scenes and you can pretty much, like, see, like, the string that it's sitting on and going towards the building, that's even more exciting to me watching it because I appreciate it more. I have that respect. Like, oh, my God, that's a smart idea to do that shot. And, like, the scene where you see the alien upstairs with the light, you know, kind of like getting closer to the light to almost trick the eye that they're becoming bigger. It's like, I'm like slapping my forehead, having even more of an enjoyment watching it because you can see how Peter was so inventive back then. And you almost like wish that let's make more people watch this movie.
Oh my
so
God.
That you can yeah. see your creative dreams come true pretty much.
For as silly as the movie is, I mean, it's truly like if you can get past that, and look at, like, it's really kind of a, I don't mean to be disrespectful to anyone else who worked on the movie, but in a way, a one-man show of, like, insane ingenuity. And it's solely yeah. the mark of someone who is, like, super brilliant because, yes, they put the rocket on the string because that's what they did in movies, but, like, they did it. Like, they did it yeah. by themselves in New Zealand, and it works enough. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. it's, you yeah. know, yeah. if you watch the making of when it's, like, him going, well, I had to build these guns, so I found some metal, and I, like, put holes in them, and I built the guns. You're like, well, that's, like, a genius doing something. Mm-hmm. Even though what they're making is sort of an absurd movie, the level of commitment and the level of ingenuity and, like, craft and everything is really remarkable. And that's, I think, what's so interesting about the movie. It's a really fun movie to watch, and it's funny, and it's gross, and entertaining, and all that. But there is something about kind of seeing the filmmaking behind the curtain and, like, championing it and rooting for it that is really unique to this movie. And I would agree, Evil Dead has an element of that, but Evil Dead is, like, a sort of more nihilistic movie in its tone. Evil Dead 2, not so much. But like there's a fun to bad taste that you're like, you're rooting for the low budgetness of it, because even though it is low budget, it's better than what you could do. And you can't help but acknowledge that. Like, you know, it's like, but for me, it was like, you know, I think a lot of people, well, speaking for myself, it's like the idea of becoming a filmmaker and entering the movie business was like just a door that was closed. And it was a door that remained closed. And I didn't even know how to get to the door. Like, it was such I don't know, people in Hollywood do that. I don't even know what that is. This was like a weird permission that like, no, you can just make it outside of that. And that's, which, you know, that speaks to the same thing with like, let's say an ex, they're making a porn movie instead of a horror movie. And because porn and horror had this symbiotic, like outsider relationship. And I think for me, anything that was sort of made outside of Hollywood was appealing to me, because I had no sense of how anyone would even get involved in something like that.
Yeah, I love that so much. I do think you're being slightly disrespectful to Peter Jackson's mum when you say you can sort of feel that one person made this, because there's one of my favorite facts about the movie is, you know, that we all know the story if we know Peter Jackson's origin tale, is that it was made piecemeal on weekends, him and his mates, you know, going out to the hills, but his mum would send them off with sandwiches every weekend. And I'm just saying that because anyone who's listening, who's a parent or, you know, planning to be a parent, it's just, when your kid starts making weirdo stuff and blowing up sheep's brains with their friends, just bring them sandwiches, because next minute they're going to be making multiplex trilogies and keeping you in the style to which, you know, you deserve, having brought them up. So I have that to say.
She also loaned the oven for a lot of homemade prosthetics. So no, for sure, a major influence on the film, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, it goes further. Also, I think that one of the things around the filmmaking that never really gets enough praise is the script itself, the dialogue itself, given that they were writing it as they went and sort of making up lines as they went. And cute little factoid is that for several years in New Zealand, I produced the weekly arts current affairs show that went out on our major television network. And each year we would run a poll, like, what is the best New Zealand painting of all time. And the last year of the series, we ran a poll on the most iconic line in a New Zealand movie. And there are many iconic to our tiny country, but the one that won was from Bad Taste. And it is one of the greatest lines in cinema, spoken by Peter Jackson. I'm a Derek.
Derek's don't run.
It is a great line. That's what I figured. That's for the moment you were heading towards. I was like, you're either going to go into, I don't know, Bastards Have Landed or something, or you're going to land on what I would assume. If you had not said that, I would have corrected you and said that would be the best line in the movie.
we should move on, but not before remarking that October is, of course, Halloween, and that October 31st is Halloween, and it's also Sir Peter Jackson's birthday, which is one of the greatest facts of all time. Happy birthday month, Sir Peter. Shall we move from one incredible blockbuster director to another? Steven Spielberg, 1981, the original Indiana Jones movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, with a script by George Lucas, Philip Kaufman, and Lawrence Kasdan. This has over 8,000 fans on Letterboxd, many, many fans. It rates at a nicely high 4.2. It's the most popular film of 1981, according to our stats, and the third highest rated for that year. And it is it introduced the world to a new adventure hero. How old were you? Where were you? Who took you to see it for the first time?
So this one has kind of a very similar, I guess, for lack of a better term, origin story for me as Bad Taste, but from a different side of the fence in a way. So I probably saw this before Bad Taste. I'm sure I did. I probably saw it when I was like 6 or 7 years old. And I had obviously seen movies before, and I was liked movies. But this was the first movie that I was very, like, obsessed with. Like, this is the first movie that movies as a thing were, like, really amazing to me. Like, I had seen movies before, and I loved them, and I always wanted to watch movies. But when I saw this movie, it was like, oh, these things are great. Whatever this is great. And unlike Bad Taste, this was a movie that perplexed me in every possible way of this movie, as far as I'm concerned, was just birthed into existence in its completed format. Like, it wasn't something that people made. It was just sort of like a door opened, this movie came out for all to enjoy, and that was that. And that's how, in many ways, like something like a Spielberg or something seemed to me from afar, because it was like every aspect of it was impenetrable to understand how it could exist. And that to me was like such an amazing pedestal and was like, obviously it's just a great movie in general. It's a very entertaining movie based on what you just said about Letterboxd. People like the movie, not a controversial opinion that Raiders of the Lost Ark is popular. But for me, it was sort of the pinnacle of like, wow, to do something like this, I wouldn't even know how to do that, but that would be amazing. And it made me think that movies in general were amazing. And I think a big part of it is the, yes, the story and the fun of the blockbuster aspect of the movie and Harrison Ford's performance, but there's a level of craft to the filmmaking, and it's very particular to Steven Spielberg. I mean, if you watch a Peter Jackson film, you can tell it's him by the way he moves the camera and by the way he focuses on other things in, or some things instead of others. Spielberg is the same way. And there's a certain level of craft in this movie in particular, all the way down to the Paramount logo turning into the mountain in the beginning, that is such like a filmmaker aware that he's making a movie and like manipulating that experience at like the highest level. And the scope of the movie is incredible. You know, there's probably no, arguably no better moment in cinema than when he like shoots the swordsman. I mean, it's like, that's such a like eruption of a moment to have in the movie, which is like in many ways breaks like out of the movie. It's an absurd moment. And it's something that they came up with like on the fly because they were running out of time. But it's like, I don't know of anything that could land better in a movie that I've ever seen in my life than when that moment happens. Like, it's the most perfect, like, we're going to stop this movie for like a Three Stooges type joke, and it's going to totally work because he's going to sell it, and then we're going to get right back to the movie you're in, and no one's going to go, well, that took me out of it. You're just going to like cheer. And the ability to do that is something that is like, I don't know, very few people on earth can do that. I don't know that I can do that. Like, that is so remarkable to me. And there's so many moments like that in the movie, and so many quotable moments in the movie, and that's a testament to, I think, just the overall craftsmanship of the movie flowing from one thing to another and being like at peak level enjoyment the whole time. And that's, you know, there's no shortage of other adventure movies that have been made, and they're just not as good.
Naughty, aka Julie Norwood, left a review on Letterboxd. You can't swing a dead cat by the tail without hitting one iconic moment after another in this stunning classic. And you talked about craft. Have you watched the Light and Magic documentary on Disney Plus about ILM yet?
I haven't, no.
Oh my God, Ty, you gotta check this out. They go through, they have so much archival footage of the team at ILM making these movies. And they get into interviews with all of the historic people behind ILM, and they talk about how they shot this stuff. And it speaks to, it reminds me of Bad Taste, like what we're talking about, Bad Taste, about the ingenuity. So much recommend. But the tagline to this movie, I mean, is this the greatest tagline of all time? Indiana Jones, the new hero from the creators of Jaws and Star Wars.
No, I could tell you what the greatest tagline ever, hands down, is from the movie House 2. So there was that, you know, it's a relatively B movie called House, and yes, which has a pretty good tagline. But House 2, the second story, is just perfect in the tagline. Like, it's a reason enough to make the movie to have that tagline.
Right. Yeah, remember the DV that he wore in the first House movie, the lead actor in that movie? Oh my God, it was like a blouse. It was so deep. It was incredible.
Well, I'm just going to derail things if I say what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. You're all talking about movie craft, and that's really nice and whatever. Can I just read this review by Kiara on Letterboxd, which I completely agree with. I mean, I've in my own, Slim and I have notes for this show, Ty. I don't know if you know that. And we also get Jack, who works with us, to provide a whole bunch of Jack's facts around, you know, where the movies stand and all of our ratings and rankings. And he gives us all of these amazing reviews and lists to point out. And then we write our notes. And my note just says, no words, just googly eyes and a dangling tongue and take me written on my eyelids. Kiara, I'm not alone. I've never wanted to fuck anyone more than I want to fuck 1981 Harrison Ford. And that's literally all I've been thinking about for the entire 2 hour duration of this film. I mean, here's the thing. So many adventure films change for me as I age and rewatch them. Like E.T. the Extraterrestrial, I watch it now from the perspective of Elliot's mum. But one thing that never changes and never will change is how I am just a horny tween whenever I watch the Indiana Jones movies.
Dr. Jones is a really, I mean, the thing is like Harrison Ford obviously was, this is post-Star Wars, and he was a very popular person. But like, I can't think of a more like you can't put somebody else in that outfit with a whip and it will work. Like, nothing about Raiders of the Ark should work. It should all be silly, and it should all be like really corny and fall on its face, and the joke shouldn't land, but it's truly like a movie star who's like, I got this. And I feel like, I don't know if it was on that movie, but there was some story I think I heard, and I could be completely wrong and attribute it incorrectly, but where Harrison Ford said something about like one movie he was doing. He's like, is this the kind of movie? I think it was Indiana Jones, where he's like, is this the kind of movie where I always keep losing my hat? And it was something where he was like, yeah. And he was like, I got it. And it was like something like that, where he was just like, I understand what this is now. I'm going to do my thing. But it's just like, it's an iconic character for a reason, but he is like, yeah. I mean, the blinking eyelid scene is incredible. Like, oh, that's an incredible beat in a movie. I mean, like, and sure, that's a script thing more than a directing thing, probably. But those two things are working so well hand in hand that it's, I mean, I'm sure you could argue that Spielberg has made better movies, or people could like someone better. But I would say that the craft, and I mean, Temple of Doom is my favorite of the three.
It's mine too. Like, I'll always come back to Temple of Doom, always.
Temple of Doom is remarkable because there's no other movie that's like it. It stands on its own island completely. It's really incredible.
And do we all agree that we just need to reignite the franchise with Kihei Kwan, with Short Round, you know, donning the hat and going around? And I saw someone tweet today, I sent this tweet to Slim, you know, and the job needs to be to go around to all the countries that have stolen antiquities and steal them back. But then I was like, but then those countries would have had to store those antiquities behind, you know, many puzzles and doors and pits of doom. So I don't know how that would work, but I'd love to see that.
I would say one of the movies I'm most anticipating, and I'm anticipating it with sheer terror, is the next Indiana Jones movie.
Oh, is, my God, yes.
I think that he's a good choice as a director. I think that I just don't know. I don't know how they're going to do it. And it terrifies me to no end.
You saw that clip of Harrison like crying they showed footage. I mean, I started crying seeing Harrison cry after seeing the footage.
Yeah. I'd like to think it could be done, but we'll just have to wait and see. But it terrifies me. In many ways, I root for them, but I do wish that in many ways, sometimes, you know, three would have been enough. But forever, Raiders of the Lost Ark will be the movie that sort of ignited my passion towards movies. And that's, it'll kind of always be on. Anytime someone asks me to make a list, outside of the sheer enjoyment of the movie, it'd always be the one that was like, ah, if only that could be something I do.
You're so not alone. Letterboxd, I mean, there's lists. Andrea has a list of movies that got us into movies. Wesley, The Basics of Cinema, Starter Pack. Josh Larson writes, has any movie done a better job of introducing its major characters? It's just an absolute banger classic, like the whole series. And I mean, Crystal Skull, we don't talk about it, I guess, but maybe I'll go back
fine.
To it.
I think Crystal Skull is fine. I think the CGI cuts it back several notches in some scenes, but I've recently rewatched it and I had a warm heart for it. Warm heart on Letterboxd for Crystal Skull. What more can you ask for? There needs to be more adventure movies, though. That's my thing.
It's
like a running theme in this podcast where I talk about like Amblin and Amblin vibes, about how they made like all ages horror, all ages adventure. And it's just so difficult for these kind of movies to exist nowadays, I feel like. But I wish someone would take up the banner, and maybe the new indie will do it for us. We'll see.
Well, I think it's a couple things. One, going back to the craft of the making of Raiders, is like, that is way above even today what most people can do. And that's a credit. I mean, if you watch West Side Story, the Spielberg version of it, whether or not you have any desire to see a remake of West Side Story, whether or not a West Side Story remake was necessary to be made, I don't know how old he is. He's in his 70s. The technical craft in the making of that is astounding. Like, it is astounding to the degree that I would argue that most people cannot do that, like, on Earth today. Like, there are sure people that could probably give it a run for its money, but it's a very, very, very small list because of how difficult it is to craft something to that specificity. And he had that, he has it now, and he had it then. And I think people think that, like, well, it was just a studio movie, and you make an adventure movie and put a movie star in it. It's like, no. Like, it's going to take way more. I mean, think of how many Jaws ripoffs there are that aren't Jaws. It's a real skill set that I think, I don't want to say he doesn't get credit for it. Of course he gets credit. He's the most famous filmmaker alive. But it's, I think it's sort of been taken for granted in a way. And Raiders is a good example of a movie that, to recreate something like that, the scope of that movie is enormous. I mean, they travel the whole world and all these different locations, and every one of them has some giant set piece, exciting element. And everything has, there's so many good lines that every scene is memorable and could compete for the better one. You know, if you like the swordsman thing where he gets shot, then you could turn around and be like, well, what about when it's like, shoot them both. That's an amazing moment. And like, they shoot them and it's like in the shadow on the walls, how you see it happen. And that's all very like traditional style filmmaking, classical filmmaking, but put into this outrageous adventure story. And I think that's really, really difficult to do. And it's not something that can be just, you can't just throw money at it to do it. You have to throw like a real vision and ingenuity about it, as you were saying for the ILM thing, which I'll have to now get the Disney Plus subscription to watch that. and I think it's like, it's, yeah, if you look at it from a filmmaker standpoint, it's incredibly difficult to do that.
I was just thinking about how much I love the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland. It's so good. It's the best ride in the whole freaking place. And then I started thinking about whether there could be a pearl ride that takes you around a lake and an alligator pops out at you like the shark does at Universal.
I'm all for this. I'm all for like when I get through this trilogy, there being some sort of theme park attraction for it. Why not?
I mean, this is what's going to put Whanganui, New Zealand on the map, right? As a pearl theme park. It's going to be amazing. You get a roast pork with maggots for lunch. Oh, it's going to be so good. Wow. So congratulations. Your second film is, and your first film, both of your films are heading towards the top five of 2022 in our horror movies on Letterboxd. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, very cool.
So congrats on that. I also saw Pearl just yesterday at the Alamo Drafthouse, downtown Manhattan. Can we talk about maggots?
Gemma has this in her notes twice, I feel like, in our Pearl section. It says, literally, can we talk about maggots at the top? And also, can we talk about maggots at the bottom? Yeah. So something has resonated.
I don't know. I just haven't been the same since I saw Bones with Snoop Dogg and had to start making a list on Letterboxd called Maggots in Movies. And
well, I'm sure Lost Boys is on that list. That's the most famous magazine I can think of. Yeah,
100% on the list, along with A Bug's Life for different reasons, non-horror. Okay, but we're talking about quite a lot about the art of cinema and the art of filmmaking. What was great about X, apart from everything, was that it was specifically about this film crew. What's wonderful about Pearl is that we get taken inside a projection booth, and not only do we have the relationship between the projectionist and Pearl going on, but we also get to see projection booth admin, you know? It's just, and so I wanted to ask you about that, and obviously there's going to be more coming in, Maxine, which you refuse to disclose to us, but really interesting and interested in how you sort of continue to show your fascination and appreciation for the filmmaking craft through these films.
Well, that was really the reason to make X. I had spent 5 or 6 years away from making movies, and I was directing episodes of television, having a great time. And I was thinking like, well, maybe I should get back and make a movie. But I was trying to figure out why I would want to do that, because I was enjoying doing television. And making a movie is sort of like 2 years of trauma at best. And I had made a horror movie in almost probably 10 years at that point, because I had made so many in a row. It just felt like I didn't want to just repeat myself, or just, you know, it's such a ordeal to make a movie, that just to set up and do things you know how to do just to do them is quite boring. And to derail your life for a significant amount of time to do that doesn't seem very appealing to me. And so I was just trying to think of what I would want to do. And I had been developing some TV series of my own and working on that. And then I just was like, you know, I felt like horror movies had gotten kind of soft, like modern horror movies. And I felt like maybe it was time to try to do something a little bit, you know, out there and a little bit gory, and lean into what I loved about horror movies. But more specifically, I wanted to, I love the craft of filmmaking. And that's what made me think like, okay, if I'm going to come back to making a movie, I want to really put the craft on display. And one way of doing that outside of me just, you know, doing technically interesting things was to try to make a modern audience be charmed by the craft of filmmaking, which I think people don't have the reverence for cinema that they once did, because it's just been, we're inundated with so many moving images that it's not as special as it once was. And so I thought, well, okay, well then I should make a movie about people making a movie, but I didn't really necessarily want to make a movie about people making a horror movie or something like that, because that just felt like a meta, too meta for what I was actually trying to do, which was trying to like, you know, show the craft of filmmaking rather than comment about like how silly it is with what, you know, I do or something like that. That's when I thought that, well, porn, like horror, were these sort of outsider genres and they could be made independently. And I felt like the story of X was to show you what it's like to make a movie and to take something that you could do without any of the permission of the system or of Hollywood and things like that. And you could create your own little business and your own little movie stars, and you could distribute it. And they're on their way with this plan to change their lives and to follow their ambitions. And they're going to use movies to do it. They're going to use a type of movie most people aren't expecting, but that's what they're doing. And it would show you that something that like the final product is supposed to be erotic, the making of it is not that. And maybe if you started to see what it was like with them making that movie, you would be thinking about some of the things I was doing in the overall movie of X, and maybe you'd have a little bit more appreciation for the craft, whether it be some of the camera work I'm doing, whether the editing that I'm doing, whether it's dual role performances, special effects, makeup, score, whatever have you, just the art form that all these different department heads are bringing to the movie. You would think, oh, this is cool, because at the end of the day, I think movies are cool. And so because of that, the characters and the tone of the movie is influenced by that type of like bootstraps, independent filmmaking. Like auteurish Americana 70s exploitation filmmaking. But none of that has anything to do with Pearl and her character. And so with Pearl, to turn this into a prequel, but more importantly, a trilogy, the other movies had to be as influenced by cinema as X was. But this type of cinema made no sense. So for me, Pearl, who's someone who has these hopes and dreams and ambitions and is like lusting after the glitz and glamour of Hollywood, she was just more affected by a different kind of cinema. And it wasn't a making a movie kind of thing. And it wasn't, we're going to do it ourselves and become stars. It was more like, I will be accepted and get a life that's better than the one that I have that I'm dreaming of. And that to me, when I picture that in my head, I picture the sort of more of a golden age of Hollywood and the sort of the glamour of showbiz and the allure that it, in theory it represents and could present for somebody. So that's kind of the approach to that. And by doing so, it was more of an observer rather than a filmmaker. And so going to the projection booth and seeing behind the scenes and seeing how it works and seeing the sort of magic of that was the cinematic influence, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it, on Pearl. And so for Maxine, it's a different thing, but it is also affected by cinema.
I thought Ty was about to drop some nugget of information about Maxine, and I was about to say, gotcha.
I'm good enough at keeping secrets at this point.
Yeah, and then the line goes dead, and it's like, oh, damn. Yeah. I have to tell you one crazy thing. I made a short film based on a family story about 15 years ago, and it has a scene in a projection booth in which a projectionist splices out a frame of film for a mother. And when I was watching that scene in your film, I was just like, oh, this is so beautiful. I love these moments. And it was also a wartime. It was World War II. Also, you know, the film was made in Wellington. So I feel like, oh, and also the donkey in our film was trained by the same animal trainers who trained your Pearl's animals.
Oh my God.
We're very linked.
Got chills.
The film was part of a bigger scene, actually, because there's quite a lot of Pearl that is not in the movie. There's like a day and a half of story that ended up getting cut out. And so what actually happened...
Director's cut.
No, it's cut out for a reason. I mean, someday there'll be a way of seeing it, but this extended versions are never better. There's a reason you take them out. It just works better. But you do miss some of the stuff. And for instance, the film blows out of her pocket and she goes looking for it in the corn, but in the script and what we actually shot is she finds it. And she finds it at the base of the scarecrow. Then when she goes home later, when she's in her room, she's like daydreaming about it and she's like looking at it and she's using a candle and she holds it up in front of the candle and the candle projects the light on the ceiling and she's watching all that and then she gets it too close to the flame and it goes up in flames and things like that. So there was more to that film and the projectionist story than is in the movie. And it's only not in there just because once you kind of got it, when you did more of it, you were kind of like, yeah, no, but I already know this and the momentum, you did feel it kind of like stall. You wanted her just to get to the dancing. It's like, that's what you wanted to get to. But there's quite a bit, I'd say like 12 minutes or something that I just, was just a wholesale lift out of the movie, which is one of the last things.
There are people are listening right now going, got to get my hands on that footage.
There's some great scenes in there for sure.
Getting hands on footage.
Box set release of Pearl. Watch at your own risk.
Yeah. I just want to explain that our film was based on a family story where my great-grandmother was watching a wartime newsreel and saw her own son, my great-uncle Jim, not on a donkey, actually on a camel, but hero animals didn't have a camel they could train. So we made it a donkey in the film. And the projectionist cut out a frame of film for her. So I don't know. It's just like people don't, it's not the same as, I don't, what do we do these days? Here's a screenshot, darling. I love you.
I love the projectionist room in the movie. I wanted to live there. He had that bed back there. I was like, damn, man, you got a great gig.
Yeah, but how about when he's like, oh, do you want to see something else? And shows her porn and then realizes he's in a little bit too deep.
Bohemian.
Oh, my God.
Bohemian. He's very bohemian.
Yeah.
I love, too, that the visuals of the movie, it almost felt like I was in that projection room. You know, the colors were popping. And some of my friends were asking me what I thought of Pearl, you know, because my group of friends, I'm lucky enough that they're all on Letterboxd, so I can see like movie reviews come in Thursdays. And it was awesome to kind of just like go in pretty much alone in the theater and have this. I had a great experience seeing Pearl in theater. There's all of my friends were talking about Mia Goth. Mia Goth is a vision. Absolute vision in these movies. The monologue everyone was talking about, that's getting a lot of the kind of like buzz, and it's 100% true. There's another scene at the credits that I do want to point out. That was my favorite scene in the whole movie. I love that you kept that in. I won't say too much about it for people that haven't seen Pearl, but man, 5-star scene. At the end of that movie. I love that thing to death. So fun.
That's funny because, I mean, that's definitely become probably the most enjoyed part of the movie. And I would share in that. But like the Cairo swordsman situation, the plan for that was to have her smile. And then I was going to like do a freeze frame because the movie opens with a freeze frame of her feeding the goose to the alligator and it says Pearl. And I was going to freeze frame with the end. And just randomly, when we were about to shoot it, I was like, hey, I have this weird idea. What if like we just try to do an organic freeze frame and cause I can stop it whenever I want and freeze frame, whatever, but I want to look for the right time of your smile that is both happy and sad at the same time. And I don't know if that's going to be 5 seconds in 10 seconds. I don't know. So I was like, just keep holding it. And she was like, okay. And so we did that and I just didn't say cut for like 3 minutes and that's what happened. And then I was like, cut, that's the end credits. And we only did it that one time. And that was just a complete random idea that happened where I was like, because I can freeze frame whenever, I don't know if it should be 2 seconds, 5 seconds, 20 seconds, let's go. And I didn't think I would go that long, but I was just enthralled watching it. And I was like, I just want to know what will happen next. And then I just went on that ride, you know, with her, just like the audience does. And it, again, one time, and that was that.
It's like a horror movie version of the ending of Police Squad episodes with Leslie Nielsen.
It's so good. I'm so fascinated to hear that. And I'd love to, I don't know, we've got two more big films to talk about, but I sort of want to hear more about the way you work with your actors and actresses. And like maybe the way into the question is, I love that you've brought Tandy Wright, who plays Pearl's mother, to the attention of the world because she is one of New Zealand's best. And her monologue also should just be drama school audition fodder for the rest of forever. She's also one of the best intimacy coordinators in the industry in New Zealand. And, you know, there's some of that going on with Pearl needing to bathe her father and, yeah, just sort of a general amorphous question about how you create safe space in films that feature death and sex.
Well, I think especially with something like, well, Tandy was our intimacy coordinator in X. That's how I met her. And we just spent a whole bunch of time with Tandy because she was there all the time in X and we just loved Tandy. And when Pearl came around, I was like, Tandy, you should audition for this. And she was like, oh, no. And I was like, well, why not? I was like, worst case, you don't end up in the movie and we have a 5-minute awkward conversation and we get back to work. Best case, you end up in the movie and then we're making another movie together. And she was like, oh, I don't know. I'll think about it. And then on one of the weekends, maybe that weekend or the weekend after, I got a link. And the link was Owen Campbell, who plays RJ, filmed it. And Martin Henderson, who plays Wayne, he read opposite her. And she did that whole monologue at the kitchen table. And she was completely off book and just nailed it. And it was like, whoa. And then on that Monday, it was like, Tandy, you're in the movie. And so it was Tandy's amazing. And she's amazing in the movie. And but the story of it was literally, I was around her every day as an intimacy coordinator and just liked her so much and thought, well, she's also an actor. She could do this. And let's see what happens. And so it's really satisfying because I like found the perfect person for the role. But I also... it was a really satisfying story to just be like, hey, let's do this together because we're already in it. But she's great at both roles. And I think on X, a big part of it too, for a movie that had a lot of sex and violence and things like that, it wasn't really a mean-spirited or nihilistic movie. It was a bit like, it was a fun movie. And I think everybody that, you know, the first question I asked everybody when talking to them, whether to be in the movie or work on the movie is, why the hell would you ever want to be in this movie? And, you know, people's answers were really like all over the map and were interesting. And I tried to really compile the right group of people who would be great in the movie, but also kind of were like down for what we were doing, you know? And so it was never a situation that like anyone would feel like something unexpected was happening. Like everyone felt like, yeah, we all know what we're doing here and we all get along and it's all fine. And the spirit of the movie was like fun and not like, you know, dark or something. It wasn't like these characters, like their lives had gone astray and they've ended up in this scenario where they have to do this. And because of that, I think just the overall atmosphere, I try to keep a light atmosphere on set as well. So it's just sort of like, you know, everybody's like happy to be there. I mean, for me, it was, I don't know if important is the right word, but it's like, you want to make a good movie, but you also want people to look back on the experience of making the movie fondly and be like, that was one of the best that I had. And I think, I'd like to think that people on X and Pearl will look back at it as a strange time in life because of COVID, but just say like, that was really great, you know, going off and making those two movies.
Do you think the cast of Tulane Blacktop had a great time traveling across 1971 America?
It's hard to know what they're thinking in the movie, which is kind of the sort of enigma of that movie is that it's, I mean, part of the reason that I picked that is that, it's probably, most likely people will think Texas Chainsaw was probably the biggest influence, say, on X. And oddly enough, it had very little influence aside from just the obvious, they're in a van and they go to a farm kind of thing in Texas. But I really wasn't thinking about that movie that much because tonally it's so different. But Tulane Blacktop, I think, is one of the, I think it might be a perfect film. I think it's one of the best examples of what an independent film in an era of like Americana auteurish filmmaking could be. Because there's nothing else quite like it, and it's such a movie that was made like on the go. And I suppose the movie exists as a metaphor and things like this, and that's all, we could talk about that in a different conversation, but I'm not, like, it's hard to articulate what it is that's great about Tulane Blacktop, which I think is sort of the magic of it, is that it's an experience, and it's sort of the inverse of Easy Rider in a way, which was also like an amazing movie of a similar time that just does like the opposite of it. And there's something about the sort of existential malaise of the counterculture kind of not living up to anything exciting that's just really special about the movie. And from a color palette and vibe standpoint, it was probably the most influential of like trying to set what I wanted X to feel like as far as like, I mean, X is certainly, the characters are more influenced by louder characters, even more like Smokey and the Bandit more than Tulane Blacktop. But like, there's something about the way America is photographed in that movie that feels so perfect of an era that it's hard to define why. And that was something that we, even down to the gas station, were really looking at. Like, we had a photo of the Tulane Blacktop gas station on the wall, and it influenced a lot of what the gas station in X looked like. And their performances in that are definitely subdued, and you don't know what they're going on, and mostly they're not talking. And Larry Bird is this really kind of magical, unprofessional actor in this movie that's just so watchable. And it just feels like aligned with a time and aligned with the kind of filmmaking that is like, there was one moment where this movie could be made and exist and it will never happen again. And that's what feels like really alive when you watch that movie. I mean, and it's also the kind of movie that people either deeply love or find to be the most boring movie of all time. Like, it's polarizing in such a like the clear line kind of way, which I think is always interesting for anything like that I think transcends being a movie and kind of falls into the art category a little bit more.
I was going to say, Slim, you're an American boy with a car you love. What side did you fall on with love for Tulane Blacktop?
I had actually never even heard of this movie until it was in your four faves. And there's one review that that mentioned like a quote, wandering existence. A wandering existence might seem alluring when in reality the odds are against you, but in Tulane Blacktop, it appears to be the last fantasy left in a jaded America. And this like reminds me of that like Letterboxd list that gets grief, but is really true about like no plot, just vibes. And I like, this has like immaculate vibes. Mm-hmm. You're following around these two in a 1955 Chevy Bel Air coupe. They race for money, betting with their competitors. Along the way, they unintentionally attract a well-to-do drifter driving a new GTO. This older man looking for attention antagonizes their efforts. It's such a strange vibe. You're right. You're just following this crew in a very slow, methodical, lazy pace. And I was sucked in the whole time. Mm. You only unravel pieces about their personality, but you like GTO, what a character. I was so infatuated with Warren Oates in this movie.
Warren Oates is amazing.
James Taylor stars in this movie, which is bonkers in and of its own right. But Warren, my God, what an amazing character on film to just pick him apart in the course of this the entire movie.
Yeah, he certainly like emits the most, you know, of between James Taylor and Dennis Wilson. But there's something about like the movie as well that feels like, you know, X was a movie where people were from a place where despite their ambition, there was no road pathway out. And then this sort of like porn filmmaking idea became like, well, maybe this could be our way to a life we want. And there's something about Two Lane Blacktop that's kind of like the anti-ambition of the era is now just landing in a place of like loneliness and sort of like shoulder shrugging. And like, there's something really weirdly existential about that, that like comes out of this movie that I think is like, is really compelling. And I don't know another movie that does it as well. Cause they're not blasting the songs of the day and being like, fuck the man. Like we don't care. It's not that, even though they're of that generation and they're the kind of people that in theory would be doing that. Like they're almost like the real life people who this is what happens versus the movie people who then get involved in some big situation. No, they just go from town to town and they make a couple hundred bucks and they get to the next race and they're just, it's like the opposite of Cannonball Run. You know, it's sort of like, this is what it would really be like doing it. And there's something about that of just like existing in this sort of American landscape in that time that feels like just so perfect.
Mm-hmm. You'd almost expect this to have a kind of loud Vietnam War era like soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, here comes this song, here comes that song. But it's pretty muted. You know, you're just along for the ride and you're feeling what they're feeling. I mean, how bonkers is it like them talking about how we might need to pick up some work just to afford the next part and then before we go to the next town, I'm like, oh my God, this life.
Yeah, like what they're after is completely not satisfying or exciting like it normally would be in a movie. Like the Vietnam soundtrack version where they're racing and exciting sequences and winning big money is a movie that makes sense. This movie is like an experience, and that's what I think is so, it's so unlikely that someone would make a movie like this. And I think that's what makes it so special, is to see like the more like real life version of a movie type story. And I think it's very rare that you get that. And also this movie, when I first saw it, I think I was like probably maybe around, it was when I first moved to New York, so I was probably like 18 or so. And this movie was out of print for a very long time. And so it was a very difficult movie. It was one of those like back when there used to be the kind of like white whale of movies of like you can't find some. This was one of those ones that was always like, if you get a chance to see it, it's really special. And every once in a while, I would play in a theater. I feel like I probably saw it at like the MoMA or something. but it, yeah, it's just a really special time capsule of a movie and a great example of like a movie that was made independently. Like they just went out and drove around and made this movie. Like it's a very made as you go kind of movie. And it wasn't improvised. There was a script, but they kind of worked day by day on the pages of the script. And that's what I think also gives it this sort of like lackadaisical charm to it, is that it wasn't like scheduled in such a way that it was a professional production. It was more like, okay, we're driving from here to here today and we're filming these scenes today. And they didn't know that yesterday. And there's something that was just interesting that Monty Hellman was up to then.
Laurie Bird, Marilyn Burns, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I want to be a 70s indie actress. Is Marilyn Burns' performance in Texas Chainsaw just one of the best of all time? That last 20 minutes, I'm exhausted every time. My God.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Texas Chainsaw is that it feels like a one-of-a-kind movie, and it there's a aggression in that movie that like leaps off the screen that no other movie has even come close to doing. And there are plenty of other demented and dark and disturbing nihilistic movies that have been made with horrific performances, but the rawness and the like just like meanness of that movie is to this day still really can't be rivaled. And so in many ways, you know, it came up a lot with X because people in a van in the 70s in Texas go to a farm. And I knew that. And I thought like, okay, let them think that. And then the movie will be something very different. And that will be a good way to subvert their expectations. And part of the reason why I was always like, the movie has less in common with Texas Chainsaw than people gave it credit for is like, the tones of the movie couldn't be more different, and the tones are what make the movie. I mean, the sort of aggressiveness to Texas Chainsaw and her just like sheer terror for 30 minutes of that movie is unrivaled by anything else. And that's like, that's what makes it like such a classic that it is it's like, at one point when you see that movie, maybe when you first see it, you think it's just kind of like a disgusting horror movie, or it's this sort of grindhouse kind of thing, or this low budget kind of monstrous serial killer thing. But as you sit with the movie and as you become familiar with the movie and you think about, again, going back to craft, like how would you even make a movie like this? It's not obvious how you would do that. It's not not clear how you would take someone to that place and to hold it consistently the whole time. And it's just a sheer dedication to, like, I don't know, terror, for lack of a better word. And that's, I think, why that movie is so spectacular. And it feels like an accident film. It feels real. And it feels so random and dangerous in a real life way.
An accident film. I love that phrasing. Jenna, had you seen this before?
No, it was a first time watch. And you say it's aggressive, but I would also say every shot is so unbelievably beautiful. And I was almost distracted by how beautiful this film is, which is such an outrageous thing to say about Texas Chainsaw. Everyone goes on about the color red on film, how it pops, but the greens in this are so vivid. Oh my gosh.
Two movies this episode with hitchhiking, and I cannot imagine hitchhiking ever in my life. It's like such a different time capsule where hitchhiking, I mean, Tulane Blacktop is hitchhiking out the wazoo in that movie, and it's totally normal, copacetic. I have so much fun watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre. My favorite scene I've written in two, I think, Letterboxd reviews is when she gets overpowered by that push broom, that like bristle broom. She can't beat him with that broom. It cracks me up. But I think I'd seen the remake first before I had ever seen this version. Who was the lead in the other Texas Chainsaw?
Was Jessica Biel?
Jessica Biel, yeah. I think I'd seen that in theaters. And I think a couple of years ago, I had watched this for the first time. I was like, oh, I don't get it. But then as I sat down and watched it, I was like, man, this would have been so mind-blowing if I had seen this as a kid. I probably would have been freaked out.
One thing is, I have friends with Texas Chainsaw, and it's interesting that both of you had not seen this, because that's fascinating to me that there could be people left that is still that experience. But I had friends, probably still have those friends, that are like, oh, I can't watch that. I can't handle it. And I was like, but you don't even know what's in it. And I was like, you really don't see that much. Like, it's not, but it infers a lot. And the spirit of the movie is so intense. But, you know, for instance, I think what people get most freaked out about is like, I don't want to see someone put on a meat hook. And it's like, well, you don't really see that. I mean, it happens, but it doesn't happen like you think you're going to see all these horrible, disgusting, bloody shots. It's not a very bloody movie. But the, like, aggressive nature at which it goes down. I mean, perhaps one of the best kills of all time is when he gets hit with a hammer in the beginning. I mean, there's like something so confronting about that you realize, like, oh, we're in deep shit in this movie. And that's what's so special about the movie.
And one of the funniest moments of all time is when they're trying to get the old man of the creepy family to use the hammer. Oh my God, this film is also so much funnier than anyone gives it credit for. And I think one of the reasons, that's exactly the reason I hadn't watched it yet, was I don't need to put myself through that. But one of the reasons I love doing this show with Slim and the team here is because it gives us an excuse to watch it when people like you recommend it. And I just, you know, in terms of one of the best kills of all time, can I just, before, we know you have to go, but I really want to compliment you on some of the incredible camera moves that you've made in Pearl, and specifically the projectionist taking the pitchfork moment. Sorry, spoilers. But that entire camera move, and then the reveal, and then the second reveal, I just love it. It's so beautifully set up. It's as gorgeous to look at as Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it's funny, and it pays off.
Well, that's perhaps a collection of bad taste, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Tulane Blacktop, and Texas Chainsaw, all subconsciously coming together and trying to you know, make some craft of my own.
Our guest today was Ty West. Pearl is in theaters now, and X is available on demand, and Maxine is coming down the pike. And speaking of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, we can't talk about Toby Hooper without talking about Hooptober. You see these hashtags and all these reviews, and you're like, what the heck is this? How do I figure it out? It's one of the biggest, best, and long-running community challenges on Letterboxd. It's run by Cinemonster, and it's never too late to dive in. The link for more information, along with all the links for this episode, are in the episode notes.
Pretty exciting. Hooptober is up to year 9.
My God.
9 long years of horror season watching. It's amazing. Be sure to also listen to Weekend Watchlist, our other weekly podcast, where Mitchell, Slim, and Mia explore the latest releases in cinemas and on streaming. That drops every Thursday, and in a small, very minor miracle, they even let me on for 90 seconds in the latest episode. Don't know how
legal,
that happened.
Legal forced my hand. Legal was behind me during the entire recording of Weekend Watchlist, and they were tapping their fancy penny loafers behind me.
Big hand on your shoulder from behind. Thanks to our crew, Jack for the facts, Brian Formo for booking and looking after our guests, Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, Sam for the art, Monica for the theme music, and Slim for keeping my 90 seconds in Weekend Watchlist this week. You can always drop us a line at podcast@letterboxd.com. We love getting your letters. The Letterbox Show is a Tape Deck production. And Slim, you Americans, you're all the same. Always overdressing for the wrong occasions.
Nice set of wheels you have here. How far are you going?
City,
well, you're in luck. I can take you all the way.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.